Hello, this is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Matt Forney. Hey, Matt, how have you been?
Thanks for having me on again, Robert. I've been mostly great, you know, with the move and everything, but you know, I'm getting back into the groove of things, and I'm happy to be on your show again.
Yeah, it's sort of like with guests, like, I guess a lot of people feel if people ask you, have you been, you feel kind of like, I guess it's not always socially acceptable to say, yeah, I feel really shitty.
Well, it's been kind of it really has been kind of a harrowing month for me, but, you know, I am getting back to the groove, you know, it's like, but yeah, thanks for having me on again.
So, our latest article is about this woman in the NAACP. She's not the nationwide president, of course. I think is she the president of the state of Michigan, NAACP?
She's the president of the Spokane, Washington chapter.
Oh, okay.
Rachel Dolezal is her name. The story is that she was actually born white, but she has been pretending to be black for the past 10 years or so, and was recently exposed by her parents.
And a lot of people are outraged by this. A lot of blacks and white liberals are outraged by her pretending to be black. But I mean, with the whole sort of transgender thing, I mean, if you feel black, can't you say like you're a black person in a white person's body? Isn't that's kind of the argument you're making?
Well, yes. The point I made in the Return to King's article is that basically. Well, a lot has argued for years that race is a social construct. Race does not exist. Race has no biological basis. It's entirely, you know, culturally constructed. And as they also argue that gender is also socially constructed. You know, there's no innate differences between men and women, which has been used to justify transsexuality. You know, if gender is a social construct, that means if a man thinks he's a woman on the inside, if a woman thinks he's a man, or if a man thinks he's actually been born with the soul of a dragon, well, then who are we to say otherwise? Because, you know, it's his feelings. Whereas a lot of leftists have been upset about Rachel Dolezal's deception. But I'm saying by their own logic, it doesn't make any sense. She claims legitimately that she feels that she's black on the inside. And if that's the case, then by the logic of transsexuality, why we can't really criticize her for that. I mean, but obviously by the state of normal rules, she's completely insane, as are transsexuals themselves. But if we're going to, say, celebrate someone like Bruce Jenner getting all these, like, awards for his bravery and such, just because all of a sudden he came out of the closet as a woman in a man's body, on one hand, we laud him, but on the other hand, we laud someone else who's basically taking the same logic, but instead of applying it to gender, we're applying it to race. I actually wrote an article for my own blog about a year ago making fun of transsexuality, kind of explaining the concept of transracialism, but the thing is, I did it as a satirical jab. I had no idea that this would actually be real, that there would actually be people doing this. But really, I mean, assuming some kind of, you know, social collapse, I don't see any sort of reversal in... this is going to be one of the next frontiers of American degeneracy, it would seem.
Have you ever seen, there's a Family Guy episode where Peter Griffin finds out, like, he's part black, so he goes to the local NAACP and, like, he starts going around pretending to be black and, like, pissing everyone off?
I think I might have seen it, but, yeah, it's basically, I'm not that familiar with it, but, yeah, I can see where it's coming from. I mean, this is basically, like, leftism sort of getting ahead of itself, you know, it's like, Dolezal in many ways is the next, another thing I talked about in the article was that there's actually apparently been a movement of so-called, pardon my French, trans niggers on Tumblr for a while now. Basically, this was reported at Breitbart, that there are a bunch of kids on Tumblr claiming that they were born the wrong race, and that they care, and they're almost entirely like, say, white kids claiming that they're actually black or whatever. To any normal person, this is indicative of some kind of serious mental illness, or at best, it's some kind of, you know, special snowflaking. You know, Tumblr is an environment where people are encouraged to be be as weird as possible and have as many weird pathologies as possible because it makes you special. You can't just be a normal person on Tumblr. You have to be like a demi-romantic, asexual, other kin or whatever labels they've invented today. But now we've actually seen it go into the real world. And I anticipate there's, I mean, it's not going to get huge. I mean, transsexuality is still relatively recent and still relatively, and the left has arguably had a hard time forcing it down people's throats. But
yeah,
I can see racism coming.
Probably, I mean, even when I was a kid, like in the 90s, I mean, trannies were sort of seen as something, kind of weird, like it would be like a joke in a movie. Or there was like the, what's it called, the Rocky Horror Picture about the drag queens, but it wasn't, like this is a sort of like the whole sort of transgender acceptance movement, I'd say, is fairly recent, like of the, basically of the 21st century. You didn't really see it so much in the 90s even.
Oh yeah, I mean, I grew up listening to a lot of Velvet Underground, and I was a huge fan of Andy Warhol back in the day, and there were a lot of notorious trannies who ran around Warhol's factory scene in the 60s, such as Candy Darling, and I think Holly Woodlawn is the other one. But back then, trannyism was, you know, transsexuality was very much a fringe thing, and the few transsexuals out there accepted that they were basically freaks, and they embraced their freakishness and the fact they weren't normal. What we're seeing now is a massive attempt to normalize transsexuality, much in the same way that homosexuality was sort of normalized. It used to be that these fringe sexuality subcultures, they didn't want to be part of the normal subculture. That was the whole point. You wanted to isolate yourself from the normals or the normies, as it were. But now we're seeing a massive push to just sort of legitimize all these pathologies. And it's the normalization of homosexuality was mostly successful because it's much easier to cover up the pathologies of homosexual behavior. But transsexuality has been a much harder sell because anyone who has encountered a transsexual in real life knows that there's something off of them. I don't say this in a malicious sense. The transsexuals disproportionately suffer from mental illness. They disproportionately commit suicide. They have difficulty getting work because the impulse that would lead you to mutilate your sexual organs or because you feel that you were born the wrong gender it's not something that should be celebrated. It's something that should be, you know, depressed.
Well, yeah, the other argument that the other side would make is that they're not mentally ill, that they're just, they have psychological problems because society treats them differently.
Well, I think it's because it's come back to the sort of bizarre leftist conception that, like, emotions dictate reality. Like, if you feel that you're a woman on the inside, everyone else has to sort of accept that. But the reality is, we are limited in many ways by our physical and mental attributes. Like, you know, if you're born a man, basically, or if you're born a woman, you have to accept that because, number one, on the fundamental genetic structure level, you're always going to be that way. Like, even if a man who wants to become a woman gets surgery and has hormones, his genetic material still marks him as a man. He still has the XY chromosomes. But more importantly, even the best, most expensive surgery and hormone treatments can't make a man into a woman. You still have that. There was recently a story, I think the transsexual MMA fighter Fallon Fox competes in the women's MMA, and she is so dominating that she's actually causing serious physical injuries to the women she fights. Because she may identify as a woman, she may have gone through hormone treatments, but she still has the musculature, the skeletal structure of a man. It's those immutable physical traits can't be overcome, and society should be our civilization. Society should be teaching people these disorders. Like, okay, maybe you feel like you're a woman, but you're going to have to accept the reality because you can't change this. And if you attempt to change it, A, people are not going to accept it, and B, you're just going to make yourself unhappy.
And basically, I mean, my stance on this thing is like I think people should have the freedom to get like a sex change operation if they want. I don't think it should be criminalized. I just disagree that it's something that's normal or healthy.
Oh yeah. I mean, I don't think it should be banned either. I think, I mean, at the end of the day, I really don't care what other people do. You know, it's your life. Live it however you want. But at the same time, you know, Like, it's like, for example, say, legalizing, we have legal alcohol, and, you know, you can get a drink, but at the same time, alcoholism is not something you want to develop. So basically, we can have these things legalized, but at the same time, we shouldn't be given the stamp of approval and pretending that it's perfectly normal to want to have your rocket flayed into a pocket or whatever.
I guess that sort of goes the different arguments. So, like, I mean, there's some libertarians who are extremely politically correct, but in general, like, well, libertarians, I mean, I'm not a libertarian, but I'm saying what their argument would traditionally be is that they say people should have the freedom to do what they want, but they're not necessarily in favor of, like, forced acceptance. But the problem isn't so much, it's not really an issue about letting people do what they want, it's that they... These social justice warrior types want everyone to be forced to accept every different lifestyle.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's the chimera, I mean, the Trojan horse of, like, accepting all these different pathologies. The left never stops tolerance. It's never about tolerance. Like I said, I can't remember I was talking with you, or maybe it was on Red Ice Radio about this, but 10 years ago, when the initial push for gay marriage was getting into gear, the argument was, you know, love isn't a choice. You can't legislate love. You know, gays have the right to do whatever they want. You know, they're not hurting you. 10 years later, it's basically become, if you don't accept gay marriage, you're a freak, and we will hound you out of white society. If you don't cater to gay Christian bakers, don't cater to gays because it goes against their religious beliefs. Are to be prosecuted by the government. It never stops at all. It's about acceptance. You eventually have to accept these pathologies, or they will run you out of flight society.
And they basically they're very sort of imperialistic and authoritarian. Like, they want, like, the whole world to accept their social values. Like, they don't like it that they see countries like Russia as not being friendly, like, not being gay-friendly enough. They want to kind of impose their values on the world. But basically my opinion on social issues is I think each community has a right to set their own social standards. So, like, you could have a community that's very theocratic, or you could have a community that's very sort of libertine. Like, I think each community should have a right to set its own social boundaries, but I don't believe that everywhere has to be... basically, like, homogenized in a sense. I don't think everyone should be forced to have the same values, like genuine diversity.
Oh, definitely. It's just, you know, like we said, basically, the left is not simply about basically. If the left was simply about saying, hey, we're gonna, you know, we've had these values, you have these values, we can sit in our own little corners and, you know, not interact with each other, that would be just fine. That would solve a lot of problems, but. The left, on the one hand, wants to impose basically their values on everyone else. You cannot, and really it is the left. Like, 10 years ago, the fear on the left, because they were ostensibly in the minority since we had Republican control of both the White House and Congress, was that the evil right wing Republican Christians from the South would impose evil Christian values on everyone else. That mysteriously never happened. In reality, I mean, the evil right-wing Christians of, say, the South and the Midwest really don't care what people outside their communities do, so long as you don't penetrate them. I mean, there's a basically the left that, living in the coast, is more concerned with what people are doing in red America than what, say, the red state America is doing in blue state America. The red staters don't give a crap, whereas the blue staters want to make the red staters conform. You know, you will conform or we will burn you out.
And this other article you have, the five modern-day social justice warriors who would have been institutionalized in the past, and you asked if social justice warriors are mentally ill. But,
well,
I think it's kind of an insult to the mentally ill to compare them to social justice warriors.
Yeah, I feel kind of guilty making that comparison, but, like, you know, we've reached a point in society where mental illness has become so normalized that we can't recognize that there are basically freaks walking among us saying freakish things we just accepted as normal. I mean, it took me living outside of the country for a few months in the Philippines last year to realize basically the standards in America, the values we hold, are completely more or less ahistorical relative to the rest of humanity. Like, we assume that we're the normal ones because we're the dominant culture and because, well, most Americans don't travel outside of the country, so we don't get that wider perspective. But the actuality is that we're the freaks. We're the abnormal people. We're the ones who are pushing completely ideas that are completely counter to what the rest of humanity holds dear. And frankly, most non-Americans look at us like we're completely insane. And as proof of this, we have completely insane social justice warriors pushing ludicrous ideas such as affirmative consent or white privilege or whatnot. And nobody calls them out on it. Nobody says, hey, buddy, you're completely insane. You know, get in your little rubber room, put the state straitjacket on, take some double down lithium, and just calm down for a while, you know?
I think with the term social justice, it's actually the original social justice movement was primarily, it was like about like workers' rights back in the early 20th century. I mean, the original social justice movement would be vomiting to be associated with the modern day social justice warriors that have the same name.
Oh yeah, I mean, this is sort of, you know, basically each generation of leftists is more left than the rest, and actually ends up repulsing the current generation. This is somewhat orthogonal to what we're discussing, but there have been a rash of, like, articles from, like, sort of left-wing academics talking about how basically their students basically scare them out because they're so scarily left-wing. I think the big example, I think, would be Laura Kepnes. She published an article, I think it was in the Chronicle of Higher Education, defending sexual relationships between teachers and students. And one of her students thought, she's a professor at Northwestern, I believe, one of her students saw it and filed a Title IX complaint against her because she was creating an unsafe environment or something. Basically, each generation becomes more left-wing, and to the point where, again, the leftists in, say, academia who are responsible for educating the next generation are basically scared as hell that their students are basically a bunch of Stalinists who are governed by their feelings and will blow them into the administration if their feelings are hurt.
And, yeah, the other thing about them is the social justice warriors is they're more concerned with the stupid, politically correct stuff. They seem less concerned with, economic inequality, for instance.
Oh yeah.
Or the police state.
A few months back, I interviewed Jordan Owen and David Cerrini, the creators of the Sarkeesian Effect, and we made this point, basically, that social justice as it exists today is actually opposed to real justice. And I gave a perfect example. About a year ago, there was an incident in Canada where a transsexual, an English transsexual who was coming over, I think to visit his or her significant other, was arrested and detained and thrown in prison by the Canadian Immigration Agency because he had overstayed his visa when attending there as a foreign exchange student a few years back. And there was a huge outcry about this online, but it was not because, basically, this transsexual was a nonviolent offender. He didn't commit any crimes in Canada. All he did was overstay his visa. He came in legally. That was the only rule he broke. So basically, this would have been a good point to talk about basically the security state, how the TSA has gotten out of control, how border control has gotten out of control, how society, both American and Canadian society, has become increasingly militarized. Throwing someone in prison over a minor visa overstay is incredibly unreasonable. The sane response would have been to basically just bar entry and send the guy back to England until he sorted that issue out. But the reason why social justice warriors got upset about this was not because of that. They were upset that this a male to female transsexual identified as a woman but was thrown in a men's prison. And they actually managed to badger the Canadian government into putting this transsexual in the correct prison. Not getting him out of prison entirely, but putting him in the right prison. That sort of perverse mentality that really is... Social justice warriors are not only not only are they trying to oppress all of us, they're inadvertently helping, they're aiding corporate exploitation of the average person, and they're aiding the government exploiting us through their through a police state brutality and security state brutality.
And I remember when we did that show a while back about the Mark Ames book Going Postal. I mean, he makes the case that American society has been a lot. I think most mainstream leftists have talk about the past as like the 1950s as being oppressive, but I mean Mark Ames actually makes the case that American society is more oppressive today than it was in the past.
Oh yes, I mean the left has this sort of cartoon vision of the 50s being sort of a stifling time where culture was dying, women would change the stove while barefoot and pregnant, blacks were oppressed, blah blah blah. Now, no one with a brain, particularly if anyone with a sense of historical sense, is not going to idolize any particular time period, because every time period had its own issues, even those that are objectively better than us. But in the 1950s, a man could support his a wife and kids on a manufacturing salary. College was relatively inexpensive. You didn't need to go to college to have a middle-class living. You could, as many of our parents' generation did, they didn't even go to college. They just became factory workers or whatever, and they were able to support a family and make a living doing that. Average pay was higher. The purchasing power of the average person was much higher. The 50s would be, even despite all of its problems, would be a hell of a lot of better time to live in today, just from a purely economic standpoint. The average American was not living in complete debt slavery like they are now.
And yeah, that's the point. I mean, social justice warriors seem to be oblivious to that.
Oh yeah, I think a lot of it is just due to the. I think part of it is just due to the fact that a lot of these kids basically have no. They can't deal with the fact that they have no economic future. This was something again I discussed with Owen and Arini a while back. Owen actually made the point that these sorts of movements, like social justice movements, these sorts of violent, oppressive, arguably, I mean, I'm not sure if I want to use the term fascistic, like authoritarian movements, tend to arise in times of economic depression. He made a parallel to the rise of the Nazis and communists in Germany in the 1930s. Right now we're living in, even though we are technically well off, but if you were born after the year 1985, you basically have no economic future. The job market is a complete joke right now. If you go to college, you are looking at years and years and years of student loan slavery in hoc to Navient or whatever company is giving you the loans now. You're going to be paying that for the better part of your life. You graduate to a completely barren job market where the best jobs you can get are maybe waiting tables. And a lot of these social justice warriors are, on top of that, are so mentally ill that they wouldn't be able to hold on a job anyway. So this is their way of coping with the fact that they basically have no future. Getting obsessed over these little non-issues and trying to deflect the fact, avoid the fact that they are basically screwed economically.
And I think that's also true with people in dissident. On the dissident right, people who are, there's people involved in the alternative right, stuff like neo-reaction. Basically, they're the same. People who don't have an economic future will get involved in dissident. Like, basically, any dissident movement will attract that.
Oh, that's definitely true. It's just, in terms of sure numbers, the social justice warriors outnumber us like a million to one. And also, I don't want to toot my own horn, but basically, a lot of these SJWs are just, they exhibit clear emotional and personality deficits. This has been talked about by the writer Anonymous Conservative in his books, The Evolutionary Psychology Behind Politics and How to Deal with Narcissists. Basically, leftists have deficient brain structures. This has been proven by medical science. Their amygdalas, which is the portion of the brain responsible for regulating fear response or atrophied or basically non-existent, which causes a whole host of pathologies. Like, for example, in rats, when scientists perform experiments on rats burning out their amygdalas, the rats will they'll number one, they'll start fornicating like madly. They'll leave their kids, if they have any, to like starve and die. They'll approach predators without any sort of concern and then end up getting eaten. And we're seeing basically those same behaviors basically in social justice warriors. They have no sense, their sense of right, wrong, fear response, and normal response to a stimuli is completely fucked. That's why they are supportive of, say, that's why they say support radical Muslims. That's why they are against, that's why they have this burning venomous hatred for normality. That's why they exhibit all sorts of issues. It's an intractable psychological gulf between the two sides that's really never going to be traversed.
And what do you think are the root causes of? This is a really complex issue of that. What do you think the main reasons that a lot of people don't have an economic future?
I'd say basically because the economy more or less was basically grifted torn apart by the baby boomer generation in the 80s and 90s more or less. The big thing that enabled the middle class prosperity of the 50s and 60s was protectionism and the manufacturing industry. It was like GM and Carrier and whatnot that formed the backbone of the American workforce. When we discussed Mark Ames' book Going Postal, when those jobs started being outsourced in the 80s, and the finality that was completed in the 90s, basically the most convenient path to a middle class prosperity was closed off to most Americans. Now you have to go to college, but the reality is most people are not intelligent enough to go to college. Which has resulted, all these people being completely unqualified to go to college has resulted in the dumbing down of the curriculum and the devaluation of a college degree. And also you have the obvious student loan, the student loan scam as well as that. So we're basically looking at, the economy is basically revolving around basically extracting as much value as from us, the peons, as possible. And leaving us out to dry while the, I don't want to sound like some kind of crazy socialist, while the 1% gets all of it, you know? That's basically why most people don't have an economic future. There's no, we're basically going to look at a situation where America is going to become a colder or less attractive Brazil. Like, and we're not even going to have, like, the few beneficial aspects of, like, living in a kleptocratic, you know, second world country like Brazil or Thailand or wherever, which is, you know, nice weather and attractive women. We're going to be fat, overweight, and we're going to be poor and in hock to the corporate machine on top of it.
So, I mean, that's a good point you bring up those countries, because I know the right wing says that Brazil is the future of America, but I mean, I've talked to people from Brazil, and in some ways they actually prefer Brazil to the United States. So maybe, I mean, the United States could end up being a lot worse.
Oh, yeah, I had a lot of problems living in the Philippines, but I overall enjoyed my experience there, and I would probably go there back there at some point. Because even though the business culture there is corrupt, even though the police are corrupt, I can get along just fine. The weather is nice. You've got attractive girls, people that are pleasant and nice to talk to. We're basically looking at a worst of all worlds scenario in the U.S., where we have the corruption and the kleptocracy of a place like Brazil, but we have none of the upsides. You know, we're going to be living in frozen, terrible weather. People, there's going to be no social cohesion. People are going to continue to be these little atomized particles with no society, no greater culture connecting us, and we're going to be poor and completely in hock to corporations and the government on top of it. So there's really no upside for us.
And even with like a revolution, for revolutionary movements to come around, people need to have a lot of social capital. And because people are so atomized, it would just, that's also a barrier to any serious dissident movement.
Yeah, and basically, and the other thing is, like, I don't want to oversell. Like, we don't have it that bad. Like, we're still a relatively wealthy country, and the average American has it objectively better off than, say, you know, the poor starving peasants of, you know, regime's past. Like, but it's the, that in and of itself is kind of a trap. People in America are kept just happy enough that they won't revolt, yet they are kept in a state of debt slavery. Like, we've got our little computers, our tablets, our iPhones to play with, video games, pornography, booze, our soma, as it were, keeping us all satisfied enough that we don't revolt. We don't notice that our pockets are being picked clean because, goddamn, you know, look at that new game on Steam or damn, we need to get one off or rubbing one out to the U-porn or whatever. Or what's on TV? I mean, that's the only thing you notice with social support is they have this stupid pile of obsession with pop culture and analyzing pop culture and obsessing over pop culture, particularly TV, because they have nothing else going on in their lives. They have no basic friends, no social life. They can't interact with other people normally. So, like, that's why you get, like, instances of, like, you know, the getting going crazy over a rape in, I think it was Game of Thrones or shit like that, because, you know, that's all they have. That's all they have in life.
Do you see that on the dissident right of people getting outraged by, like, pop culture as well?
I see some of it, not so much. But personally, I'm of the opinion that you should just tune out from pop culture entirely. Like, my current lifestyle is that I don't really watch TV at all. Like, I don't own one. I don't have, like, a Netflix account. There are occasional TV shows and movies I will check out, but I don't make a habit of going. I don't pay attention to the news as well. Pretty much all my news comes from Twitter and Facebook, other people talking about it. We should lead by example, and instead of filling up our minds with intellectual junk food. I focus on reading good books. I focus on writing. I focus on hanging out with my friends and networking with intelligent people. I focus on productive endeavors like chess or playing the guitar or whatever. Don't get me wrong. I like to play video games every so often. I have my vices, but obsessing over pop culture and trying to hyperanalyze it and getting offended because, you know, of things happening in a TV show you don't like is not psychologically healthy. And the fact that so many people are just, you know, getting obsessed into it, not just on the right, but, you know, and people in general, is indicative of just, you know, a serious pathology in our society. We're just looking for escapism, and we've lost the ability to discern distinguish fantasy from reality.
Well, you did do that show about that new Nickelodeon sitcom, Bella and the Bulldogs.
Yeah, there's a certain value in cultural analysis, especially with something so ridiculously outrageous like Bella and the Bulldogs. I mean, it's so ridiculous, I can't even make it up. Like, a guy who makes a cuckold fetish, you know, art film movie gets hired to do a children's show, and he inserts all these, like, surreptitious references to cuckolding in it. Like, you have to point something like that out. But at the same time, you know, it's like, don't obsess over it.
How explicit is the new TV show? Is it more implied, or is it pretty explicit?
Well, it's there have been like children's TV shows in the past, like Animaniacs, that will sort of like insert adult jokes in that are designed in a way that they'll go over the kid's head. So, like, a kid and adult can watching together, like, the kid will laugh at the kid jokes, but the adult will see the little fly joke there, and, like, then they'll chuckle for themselves. Like, Animaniacs is really good at that. That's probably why that was such a popular show. But Bella and the Bulldogs is full of all these, like, they were probably intentional, references to the cuck subculture. Like, for example, the very name Bulldogs alludes to the fact that in cucking, the term bull is used to refer to usually like black men who are brought in to have sex with a guy's wife while he cries in the corner and masturbates. And also one of the big plot threads is
that sounds pathetic.
It's just absolutely it's grotesque. But basically, And also, well, the premise of the show is that it's about, for those of you who don't know, it's about, it's a Nickelodeon TV show about a girl named Bella who becomes the quarterback on her high school, you know, football team. And one of the threads of this is that, you know, she's, she has a crush on one of her fellow players who is a black guy, whereas there's another white guy on the team who has a crush on her, which... That might be inadvertent. That might just be politically correct casting, but it's way too close for comfort, particularly with the whole Bulldogs thing. And there are a bunch of other references in it as well. I haven't delved in it as deeply as, say, Beckloff or other people have. But
is the white character depicted as kind of like nerdy?
Oh, he's very nerdy. He's an incredibly to use a red pill terminology. He's very beta.
And how's the black character portrayed?
Way more masculine than the white guy. That's for certain. Like, well, we are talking about, you know, it's a show starring teenage actors geared at tweens, but basically, the black character is portrayed much more positively.
Would you say this is new to? I mean, it's not new to TV, but I'd say it's new to like stuff geared towards children. But I'm sure you see stuff like this all over the place. You see it in commercials a lot.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Nickelodeon has been sort of politically correct. This sort of political correctness has been sort of slowly creeping into children's programming for a long time. I mean, when I discussed this with the Beckloff and Liam Rohn, I compared it to... I gave an example of a... When about 10, 15 years ago, when I was, you know, still young enough to watch Nickelodeon, there was this short-lived TV show called Pelswick, which starred the main character was a paraplegic handicapped kid who lived with his grandmother. Like, one of the most PC premises you could think of. But this is way on another level. Like, then not just the cuckolding aspect, but you add in the freakish gender bending aspect of a girl being a quarterback on an otherwise all boys football team. So you've got that sort of normalization of, well, it's like, hey, a girl can do anything a man can in terms of. So this is probably the most explicit example of like politically correct and political correctness and sexual perversion being put into children's programming to date.
Are you personally opposed to interracial sex, or is it more the cuckold aspect that bothers you?
I mean, I don't care about interracial sex, and I don't care about, you know, if people are into cuckolding, you know, it's like, you know, I'm not going to judge. You know, we all have our weird sort of sexual fantasies. The cuckolding aspect on kids who are too young to understand it. I also, you know, kind of object to, you know, this has been a constant thread in, you know, as you mentioned, in commercials and adult programming where white men are, and men in general and white men relative to black men are emasculated and depicted as chumps. I'm sort of against that. I mean, you know, obviously I wouldn't ban it entirely because, you know, the broad spectrum of, you know, humanity, there are chumps and buffoonish men, but at the same time, you know, Hollywood and popular culture has a pretty obvious anti-white, anti-male, you know, streak going through it. And this is just the latest example of it, targeted at kids who are too young to know any better.
Yeah, I mean, they're at the stage, like, it caters to girls about ages, like, 8 to 13, 8 to 14, so, like, their brains are still, like, developing.
Oh, definitely. Kids have no clue what the hell they're going on. What's going on? I mean, you know, we've got it's incredibly irresponsible at best to do stuff like this. At worst, it's actually subversive and malicious. I mean, back when I was a kid, I mean, I'll give you this example. My mom would not let me watch Sesame Street because she said it was communist propaganda. But Sesame Street is kids play compared to something like Bella and the Bulldog, you know.
It's funny as I was watching like an old old Pee Wee Herman show, the Pee Wee's Playhouse, and I watched that as a kid. But I was noticing there is like sexual innuendo in some of it.
Well, I'd say Pee Wee Herman is a whole different, well, Pee Wee Herman originated as an adult character before being remade into something for kids. But basically, with Pee Wee Herman, it was incredibly, it was very subtle. Like, a kid is not going to notice that, and...
I didn't notice it as a kid, but then I watched it later as an adult, and he kind of winks, and the thing pops, this, puppet pops out, erection joke.
It's as if that a kid wouldn't notice it, but it wasn't intended for a kid to notice it. Like, the creators of shows like that put the jokes in explicitly to aim them at adults, and did so in such a subtle fashion that the kids wouldn't see it. Whereas with something like Belle and the Bulldogs, the adult aspect of it, if you can call it that, is just so... It's completely inseparable from the rest of it. Like, it goes down to the very foundation, and that's what makes something like that so subversive and dangerous and frankly reprehensible, you know?
In your social justice warrior article, you also... I'm not going to get into a list of, all the different historical comparisons, because, that would take, a whole hour. But you talk about the Marquis de Sade, and we talked about the Jonathan Bowden's book, Sade, a while back.
Yeah.
But what's interesting about Sade is that he basically was a nihilist, but social justice warriors are very, the difference is they're very hyper-moralistic.
Oh, yes. I made the point in the article, I compared the Marquis de Sade to Gian Gomeshi, the former CBC radio host who is currently facing criminal charges for beating and raping women, the feminist CBC radio host. I compared the Sade because they, number one, their sexual proclivities are pretty much identical. Gomeshi was into BDSM and skirting the line of consent, and I mean really skirting the line of consent, not the way feminists talk about it. There was one bizarre incident where one of the girls that is alleging he beat and raped her, like when he was they were in his bedroom and they were having sex. Apparently, Gomeshi has a teddy bear called, he calls Big Ears Teddy, and when he was about to tie the girl up or whatever, he turned the teddy around so that its face was facing away, and he told the girl, Big Ears Teddy doesn't need to see this. That's incredibly creepy. And the comparison to Sade is obvious because Sade himself was a feminist of his era. He was against the patriarchal mores that were overthrowing the French Revolution. He was against the social constraints that were put on men and women because they got in the way of him having fun.
And I mean, he was really ahead of his time. I mean, I don't want to be too crude, but I mean, he wrote about stuff in his writings like facial ejaculations that are stuff that really didn't become prevalent in porn until 15 years ago.
Oh yeah, I have nothing against Sade. I mean, I've enjoyed his writing as well, but I'm not going to hold the guy up as a moral model for anyone to follow, you know. And basically, if someone like Sade were alive today, he would probably be a social justice warrior, because he was a social justice warrior in many ways of his time.
But he was more, I don't know, I mean, he's more of a nihilist. I mean, nihilists I don't know if nihilists tend to dislike social justice warriors because they're hyper-moralistic. There's definitely a nihilist streak, a site like Royce is very kind of nihilistic.
I could say there's SJWs are hyper-moralistic, but I don't argue that there is a streak of nihilism in the social justice ideology. It's or maybe not nihilism per se, but a whole sort of, let the world burn mentality, because social justice warriors hate the world as it exists. They hate what they see as racism, sexism, class oppression, transphobia, homophobia, etc. The comparison I would make is that a few years ago, the now departed conservative commentator Lawrence Oster wrote an article about John Lennon's song Imagine, which most people perceive, you know, Imagine as being a sort of hippy-dippy, you know, anthem of love to the world, you know, the whole no religion to everyone living in peace and harmony. And Alston made the point that Imagine is not a song about love, it's a song about hate. Because Lennon was talking about how he hated the world as it existed. He hated the things that made humanity unique, that made different cultures unique, and he wanted to destroy all that. So you could argue that socialist warriors have a nihilistic streak in them, and they want to destroy the world as it exists, to fit a vision of utopia that could never, ever conceivably work.
And with, yeah, John, it's interesting because, like, John Lennon, like, you see his image on a lot of corporate advertising. Like, I think it was, like, Apple's campaign. But I guess with society, like, this sort of corporate consumer society has kind of created a world like John Lennon's song Imagine, where people are not part of any cultural or ethnic religious group. Just the whole world is just nothing but a consumer.
Yeah, we just mindlessly, we buy all the same stuff. We listen to the same, you know, auto-tune songs on the radio. We watch the same mass-produced, CGI-heavy Hollywood movies. There's nothing that separates us from, there's nothing that makes us unique. And if the corporates get our way, all what few distinctions that separate humanity will be just erased entirely. We'll all be on the global feedlock, you know, watching our flat screens, playing our video games as, you know, the last vestiges of money are picked out of our pockets.
You are recently went to the last AMRIN conference. How did that go?
It went incredibly well. I mean, there was some drama involved. I really don't want to get into that. But I decided to go to AMRIN a while back because I wanted to experience something different. I was just curious as to what would happen at the conference. You know, I wanted to network with people, and also because just, you know, I wanted to experience something different. And I was, I'll fully admit, I was somewhat worried about the reception I might have received, which is why I didn't announce that I was going there publicly, and basically no one else there knew that I was going to be there until I showed up.
Why is that?
Because, well, I'm friends with William Rome, who is somewhat involved, a former white nationalist activist. And he said a lot of them were somewhat icy towards me because they were upset that I went to the Philippines to basically sleep with, you know, Asian women. You know, I'm a filthy race traitor, as it were. I mean, I should have, you know, probably realized that if they're going to invite someone like John Derbyshire as a columnist, a guy who actually married a Chinese woman and had children with her, I mean, but basically, but as it turns out, you know, my fears weren't founded because I had a pretty good time. Everyone there was civil and polite to me. I mean, there were two exceptions, obviously, but we're not going to get into that. Everyone I met was, even if they didn't agree with me, you know, it was like we were all civil, we could break bread easily. I made a lot of new friends. I met a lot of interesting people. I actually got to meet John Derbyshire, Ramsey Paul, Peter Brimlow of VDare, Sam Dixon. I talked to Jared Taylor himself. I also met some notable white nationalist activists such as Matt Parrott and Matthew Heinbach of Traditionalist Youth Network.
You were saying that you sort of made fun of Matt Parrott a while back, so you were joking that it was going to be a little bit awkward, but it ended up, like, people were cool.
Oh, yeah.
People make fun of each other online, but when you talk to a person face-to-face, it's different.
Oh, yeah, we were busting each other, you know, in person as well, you know, it's like, you know. When you take it into the real world, you know, things become so much easier. And in the case of Heinbach, I was a little worried with Heinbach because, you know, I respect him a lot. He's a very serious, he's a bit younger than I am, but he's very serious about, you know, his activism. He's already married, and he takes this seriously. And relations were a bit icy because we were a bit worried with each other. But, you know, by the end of the first night, we were literally bro-hugging and, you know, and being, you know, what's the term? We were the best of friends. So it was like, if two people like us who are from completely different, you know, have completely mentalities can come together and basically, you know, be fast friends, then there's really no excuse for sort of eating the right, no enemies on the right sort of mentality that some people in the manosphere or the alt-right like to engage in. You know, it's like, from this point forward, I'm not going to, like, criticize. If someone's being incredibly stupid, yeah, I'm going to call them out, but I'm not going to, like, criticize, like, say, people who are ostensibly aligned with me just because we disagree on a few doctrinal disappoints. Like, this is why I stopped discussing white nationalism, even though I disagree with some aspects of it, because they're on my side, more or less. You know, they are, as much as I may disagree with them, they're fighting in their own way for my interests, and they're better friends to me than, say, I don't know, the left is my enemy. The left is our enemy. So there's really no reason for us to constantly form circular firing squads. And my experience at Amran sort of hammered home that point to me.
So you basically agree with them on most things except for the Philippine issue.
Well, I disagree with sort of, you know, the sort of organizing a society around a sort of, you know, prefab white identity, but at the same time, you know, I am a white person, and you have to, and I have to, you know, I think it's Robert Lindsay has a quote from Hillel on his about page, basically saying the same thing. You know, it's like, if I'm not for myself, then who am I for? So even while I may disagree with someone like Heimbach on certain political points, he's fighting for me. He's fighting for my interests. I'm not going to, you know, attack him for basically doing what's right by his estimation. Even though I may disagree with guys like him, you know, we can disagree, but we can still be friends. We can still be civil about it.
And I've noticed, you talked more about that stuff in your old Malafita blog. That kind of.
Yeah, a lot of it was just me shooting from the hip, and honest to God, you know, I was like, I mean, I joked about this prepared to conflict. I was kind of an idiot back then. Well, my excuse is I was a lot younger. Like, I like to think that I've grown up somewhat, and, you know, to coin a term, nowadays I don't talk shit about shit I don't know nothing about.
So, this other article you have is 4 reasons why living abroad is not all cracked up to be. And you talk about just, like, basic standards of living, like, there's not, like, in a lot of, like, oh, even when you're in the Philippines, just, like, not, there's not basic sewage removal, and just everything's really dirty, and just cities are poorly planned out. You see, you'll see nice high-rises surrounded by just blocks of, shacks.
Tin shacks and candy
pumps, it's like a game of Sim City being played by a sugar bomb spaz.
Yeah, basically, the whole concept of moving abroad and being, you know, location independent is, like, you know, worship in the manosphere. That's the ideal you're supposed to be working towards, you know, quitting your boring 9-to-5 job and just living as a digital nomad in the third world. And I'm not bashing it, okay? I enjoyed my time in the Philippines. I'm going to be doing some more foreign exploring at some point, possibly in the near future, but it has downsides that people sort of, you know, idolize this lifestyle don't realize. Like, the basic infrastructure problems is just number one. You're not going to have many of the amenities you have in a first world country in a place like the Philippines. Like, when I lived in Davao City, the power grid was not very well maintained. Brownouts and blackouts were fairly common, to the point where pretty much any building of, you know, with any money has a backup generator installed, and even those don't work some of the time. Like, I in the first month that I was there, I probably went through three blackouts, whereas, you know, in a normal situation in the U.S., you maybe get 3 blackouts a year. The internet is somewhat dodgy. Internet access is somewhat dodgy. I had difficulty, for example, watching YouTube videos because of a lack of bandwidth. Water is, well, I never had any problems in Davao with, like, tap water, but you're supposed to, you can get sick and some stuff like that. And when you're walking around the streets of Davao.
Did you ever get food poisoning?
I did get food poisoning from a burger, and I learned my lesson there. Is like, basically, you have to worry about that as well. You have to, basically, a lot of the things that we take for granted living in a first world country don't exist there, and you can work around this. I mean, I worked around it mainly by investigating, you know, being careful where I ate, you know, and just sort of, you know, going with the flow and enjoying what was available to me there. But for someone who's used to living in first world creature comforts, you know, it can be a big shock.
I also have heard people complain that, like, the food in the Philippines is not so good. Like, I know, like Thailand is known for having great cuisine, but I've heard a lot of people complain that food in the Philippines is not so good.
The food is terrible. I describe the native cuisine as basically like being a sort of mashup of Malaysian, Chinese, and American cuisine. Like, all the worst aspects of it, none of the upside. There's a lot of salt and sugar. Like, for example, there's a local fast food franchise called Jollibee, which is basically a heart attack in a bun. I kind of grew to like it because it was relatively cheap, and people laugh at me when I say this, but in many places in the Philippines, like, a McDonald's will be one of your best cuisine options because you at least know the food has been tested. Another thing, like malls are very popular in the Philippines. Like, people tend to hang out at malls, but the restaurants there tend to be ugh. Like, that was when I got food poisoning. I went to this, like, American-style diner, and the burger was incredibly undercooked. You have to, again, it's something you can get around with by just, you know, knowing where to go, but at the same time, you know, it's something, ugh. No one is ever going to move to the Philippines for the native cuisine.
And this other article you have is you talk about moving to other cities and what are things you can do to be prepared if you move to a new city.
Yeah, this is also basically for the past year now, I've more or less lived on the road, more or less. I've, like I said, spent 3 months in the Philippines last year, and when I came back from there, I think I've spent at least like 2 weeks of each month on some kind of vacation, whether I'm in New York, Chicago, Cleveland, Memphis, Nashville, some other place. Moving to Chicago was basically the first time in a year that I've settled down more or less for longer than a month. And it's very psychologically stressful. This also ties into the whole, you know, manosphere worship of being location independent. Constantly moving around and monitoring and dealing with the logistics of going from place to place and that sort of thing, it's expensive, and it's also very psychologically taxing. Human beings were not meant to move around like that constantly. We're intended to sit down, to sort of, you know, put down roots in a particular area. And when you try and move around, depending on your psychology, it can really throw you off. One of the big problems I had when living in the Philippines, again, is the lack of social interaction. Like, the average Filipino was very friendly, but, you know, I didn't have any friends over there. I had a couple of readers of mine in Davao that I hung out with. That was pretty much it. I knew some, and I knew a couple of people in Manila, but aside from that, it was basically me on my own most of the time. And you basically get the same thing when you're living as a nomad. Living in Chicago now is the first time in about maybe 2 years that I can hang out with my friends on a regular basis and get that social interaction that basically human beings need to function.
So, Matt, I'd like to thank you for being on the show. It's been a great show.
Thanks for having me on again, Robert.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.